This is a Stimulus Network podcast.
Hello and welcome to Eureka Nerd. I'm Will.
And I'm Leah. And this episode, we have got an interview with Dr. A.C. Lamborn, author of Our Accidental Extinction.
And we can confirm that the reason why we had such trouble finding him in the previous episode in the weeks leading to it was because it is a pen name to protect the author's privacy. So we're going to respect that and not do any more digging, and we're not going to blow this dude's whole scene. So Dr. A.C. Lamborn does exist, but not under that name for academic purposes. Now, interestingly, Dr. Lamborn has listened to our previous episode and still agreed to come and do this interview, which is very polite considering the things that we had to say and the opinions that we formed based on our reading of his book.
So thank you very much, Dr. Lamborn, for coming to talk to us, even though we were horrible about you, and for being...
We weren't horrible, we had concerns.
Yeah, being willing to talk to us.
And take on the concerns and feedback that we had. Because this was, again, a preview version of the book, so there's every chance that we'll get a mention in the acknowledgements of whatever second edition comes to say, hey, these guys gave me some things to think about. We'll have a bibliography at the end of that. That'd be nice. So without further ado, let's get started. As you surmise from our episode, we do have some notes and questions.
Yep. Just a couple.
It's fascinating that we've kind of at the end of the book, like the solutions chapter, that you propose things that we ultimately agree with as well. Leah's got some other family Zoom stuff happening, so she's not joining on this call just yet. But that we both agree in like the ultimate socialist utopia of like supporting people through family rearing and childhood and like making every provision possible to give people as much flexibility in making the right choices for them. But the middle parts between like the reasoning for that, we seem to diverge quite heavily on.
Yep. And that's okay. Yeah, I understand. So like, I mean, if you just want to know me from a political standpoint, you know, I'm pretty far left. So I think Leah was a little believing that I had grown up in a heavily religious and perhaps a right side of things. But I'm pretty far left leaning for most things, you know, in almost all aspects. And I'm a atheist. I've always been an atheist. So those were, you know, interesting points hearing somebody surmise from the book, because I actually got that from one other person as well, who was, I wonder whether you're religious or not. So
hearing that feedback, hearing that come back, do you connect kind of the dots in like our thinking and how we've reached those conclusions from what's written in the book, or is that something that you are not, that you didn't expect to see reflected?
Maybe something that I'm not, wasn't completely expecting to be reflected. I think just because I don't understand how the reader doesn't know me. And so I think that people, when I'm writing, I'm assuming that people understand where I'm coming from. And then that any of my critiques or criticalness is not as a general, you know, negativity towards something, but as a critique of it or a way that we can improve it, I'd say.
Well, I will admit the pseudonym does add a layer of distance between here and there, because as we mentioned in the first episode, that it is my job professionally to go and find people and like check their credentials and make sure they are the right expert for a project, or like make sure that there is consensus around what they are discussing. So, I mean, I will admit, I enjoyed the mystery of trying to find out who is Dr. Lamborn.
Did you figure it out?
We have not got a solid answer yet, and I will respect the privacy for using a pen name.
I'll just tell you right now, I was planning on telling you beforehand. And then when I heard it, I became more concerned that, okay, well, maybe they're looking to out me or to, you know, expose me as some sort of fraud or something. Or so.
Not the exposition, but kind of just for like the due journalistic diligence of checking that, like saying that you have credentials at these universities. I did check with those universities if they knew who you were, and like they didn't respond to the name Dr. Lamborn, which then kind of raised suspicion of
Yep.
This has clearly been written by an academic. The entire chapter of references at the end is very tastefully and artfully done in a Harvard style, and I respect that. But yeah, that the mystery builds, and that kind of does shake the foundations of some of what I think comes through in the book.
I think that this people have written anonymously in the past on similar topics, like Malthus' principles of population, very similar, wrote anonymously. Eventually he came forward and provided his name that he had written it, but you know, I think they're delicate topics, and so I respect my privacy, and I even if people all respected it, like Anthony Fauci, you know, a lot, I don't know, you know who he is, he's an American, yes, a lot of people respect him, but he's getting death threats, you know, for him and his family currently, you know, and so I do not want to be a public figure. I don't have, my intention for writing this book is not to become a public figure. It's more to illuminate problems that I see as occurring and potentially causing negative consequences in the future. So we can start, so too, yeah, if you want to. I know I already am starting, so.
No, the background of things, I think, is a good introduction to yourself. And respecting privacy is a good starting point, because, again, you don't want to go blowing anyone's cover with anything there. But, yeah, the sensitivity of the topic in question did kind of come under much greater scrutiny in the period of recording and editing the episode after we got the book in the post, because the Lancet report on the fertility crisis came out, and there was BBC coverage, global news coverage, of a looming fertility crisis after we'd just been reading all of the super stimuli suggestions in this book as to the cause of it. And I was wondering what your take or your position, has that been validated in any way by a paper in the Lancet with the authors attached and getting all of this coverage discussing a very similar set of initial evidence, even if the interpretation of it, to put it delicately, as to the cause of it was not so clear in their paper.
Yep.
Seeing as like the world suddenly started talking about this problem, then how did you feel about that?
I think it's a good first step to be able to at least communicate about it and to have researchers looking at it. I make sort of four claims in here, and each of them are not, you know, they can be controversial. You know, the first claim is that there is a large a number of population decline that will occur due to low fertility, and I think that follows what the Lancet projections provide. You know, I think that they're very similar in terms of the interpretation of that. I think the next part where that you brought up is that there is a disconnect on the next part, where I believe this will lead to massive cultural extinctions. You know, that they will lead to the Japanese extinction, the extinction of the Italians, the Greeks, the British, the Brazilians, the Puerto Ricans, the Cubans, you know, all over, you know, that there will be massive cultural extinctions due to this. And I don't think that Lancet article moves to that step. So I think that that's another place where people need to start looking at how this is going to evolve into the future and what are the consequences of it. And so, yeah. And so that might be a part where Lancet was different in terms of interpretation.
And that cultural perspective does lead on to one of the questions that was raised in our review of the book in the previous episode, of migration happens. People do move between countries and do adopt the national characteristics of the country they're in. They have children who are nationalized and brought up in a culture. And seeing as there are ways in which talking about population and cultural extinction edge up against some very, very uncomfortable areas of politics and of culture. And I mean, you have identified some very strong cultures there. The cultural exports of Italy, of Japan, of England, like the cultural identity is very strong. And people, like, even without having children, out being first generation immigrants, I'll say even first or generation immigrants into a country who are, like, they move there, they become naturalized, they become citizens, they are of that nation. There are people who have been in England for under 5 years, but they are to me and in the eyes of the law, still British, and they are part of English culture, then that population, the global population, with all of that still happening in all of those cultures, is still growing. And suggesting that a culture will go extinct because the native population is not replacing itself at the same rate, that does feel not probable. If you see what
I'm saying. Yeah, no, I totally see where you're coming from. So two things. One is that not every country has high immigration to it. Japan doesn't have high immigration to it, for instance. And then on the second point is people migrate to, let's say, England. We'll take England as an instance. And many of them largely acculturate to English culture. Some of them don't, you know, there are differences there. But then when the native population, in terms of the words you use, disappears over time, and those immigrants disappear over time, their ancestors or their descendants disappear, then there's a slow movement away from the current culture, and then perhaps more immigration occurs, and you know, maybe it's a slow move away, but eventually that immigration stops occurring because multiple countries that are now over-reproducing will stop over-reproducing. You know, many cultures that are overpopulating themselves will have changed the trajectory. You know, they're starting to modernize. The effects of that modernization are starting to take hold in those countries, and eventually this migratory pattern will stop. And so the native, you know, people from England will have disappeared. The immigrants who have come to that country will have disappeared, and there will no longer be migrants to continue that culture. So I believe that over time, even though England might be a slower rate of extinction due to this immigration, that eventually the people of England, and the US is another where there's a lot of immigration, and a lot of the subcultures within those will disappear as well. So a lot of the Native American populations in the US will disappear, because despite there being migrants who come into the US, you know, they're the subcultures within that country will disappear as well. And so I think these cultures matter, and I wholeheartedly believe that they will disappear, many of them, due to under reproduction in these countries, and that's cause for concern.
Will there be some kind of like generational equilibrium at some point? Because I mean, the cultural extinction angle does feel very immediately reversible in a country that is as down to do you mind if I swear? It's already happened.
That's okay, don't worry.
Yeah, in a culture that is as ready to bone down as the English, especially, and that is kind of a cultural issue that does not translate equally to Japan. But like people, and this comes up in the solutions, can be incentivized to reproduce. New generations of people who embrace and adopt that cultural identity by becoming English, Japanese, Greek, wherever, they are still perpetuating that. And like cultures do change over time. Modern English culture is very different from that of the 40s or that of the 1910s. Like there is still always a cultural progression and change and modernization. The equilibrium of migration, immigration, naturalization, do you see that reaching an inflection point where it's stable? Because even with what you've raised just now of how like that second generation or that second replacement wave of immigrants or migrants wouldn't keep reproducing, by that time in that future, after all the evidence that has been raised in your book and in the Lancet paper has been acknowledged, there is still every chance that people will be living in the futuristic socialist utopia that allows them to have as many children as they want and need without worrying about resources or housing or whatever.
Yeah, and so I don't believe that that's the sole reason why people are not reproducing. So I don't think that the lack of support is the only reason. I think that there are a number of different factors that lead to individuals to under-reproduce. And I talk about, you know, some of them in the book, and I think you might have found fault with some of them as well. But that modern societies are very rewarding in themselves. You know, and we've produced a culture that can provide lots of rewards for individuals, and that children haven't become more rewarding over time, that children are still similarly rewarding as they were in the past, and comparatively less so compared to the societies that we live in. And so I believe that if you just give people the opportunity to have kids with fewer of the negative consequences, I think that will improve things. But those positive influencers won't be as powerful unless we recognize the problem. And so I'm hoping that people will recognize the problem.
Yeah. Well, some of the cultures that have been wiped out in the past couple of hundred years of Western imperialism led by the British, they certainly placed a lot of pressure on people to have family. There was a lot of reward and emphasis on a family unit that was quite functionally wiped out through much more immediate means than kind of the slow extinction. And there are cultures who are fighting for their survival on many islands and nations and territories that have been colonized and westernized by European immigrants over the last couple of hundred years, who are still fighting for their way of survival. And like, in terms of a priority, you acknowledge that there are different pressures on different peoples for their survival, especially in the here and now.
Yes. So, I mean, I think that if a culture has fewer numbers, that the impact of this can be even greater, you know, so that if a culture doesn't have many individuals left and individuals are reproducing at sub homeostatic levels, and there are outside forces that are potentially influencing them, like the Uyghurs currently in China are being acculturated into the broader Chinese culture forcefully, I think that, you know, there are lots of pressures and there are lots of things that we should look at. I don't think that one prohibits looking at others as well. You know, I think we need to tackle all problems that occur.
Yeah. Well, to come back to what you're just mentioning about the causes of population replacement loss, super stimulus, as described in this book, being the enhanced arousal or the more rewarding arousal of pornography, of the surgically altered female form or the aesthetically altered female form on men. How, listening back to our first episode, did you take our thoughts that this seemed like a very male-focused perspective?
Oh, interesting. I mean, I believe it's could be. You know, I don't admit that there couldn't be bias on my end, that I pay more attention to male points, you know, in the book, and I recognize them in myself and others around me more. It could be that they're overemphasized, but I do think I tackle a number of female super stimuli as well.
Well, some of those super stimuli being celebrities and portrayal of the ideal male form through media. And even then, the ideal male form varies, well, the presentation of male form in media varies much more wildly than it does of a female form. And the reproductive emphasis that you said of coming out of a cinema and that women might not want to remain or reproduce with their partner because they are not, we gave the example of Henry Cavill in The Witcher because he is a fine example of the human species. But that the standards for male performance are set that highly, and yet, again, to put it somewhat impolitely, ugly people bump uglies.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's the matching hypothesis in psychology, you know, shows that people find partners who are of a similar attractiveness level to them. And so I believe that there are situations where the constant exposure to ideal mates, and that isn't just looks, you know, but situations where people act superhumanly as well, act in a perfect manner or have these life epiphanies, causes us in some degree, and this isn't a huge degree, but to not appreciate our partners as much, and in particular to discard partners initially that we might form meaningful relationships with. And so I don't think it has as much effect on, you know, I mean, you and Leah, you know, I think that you're in, it seems like you're in a stable relationship, and I don't think that you going and seeing that movie is going to suddenly make you guys break up. But I think it does have some effect on the ability for us to start and maintain relationships. And I think this, of the three, is the lowest of the importance of the factors. So the three that I kind of discuss are the factors that lead to less partner acceptance, factors that lead to us to avoid reproductive sex, and factors that lead us to avoid having children. And I think those three are three things that stop us from having children. And I think the partner one is relevant, but I think of the other two have a even stronger effect.
I'll come to those other two in a second, but to say that we might appreciate our partner less based on their inability to reach fantastical standards that we set on them does feel like a very juvenile take on what it is to exist as a human in the real world. And I'm not going to deny that lots of people do have a very disappointing view that, I know, Captain America would never treat me like this, but the idea that that would lead to the end of a relationship. Again, this is a very academically written book, but I do not believe that had a citation to it. And do you know of any ongoing research to confirm if that is something that happens, or is that, again, your inference?
Yeah, there is some research to suggest that when people are provided images of attractive people of the opposite sex, they report less commitment in their relationships. And so that's just reported. It doesn't mean that it leads to any sort of behavior, but you know, there's reason to believe that there's potential there.
We're queer.
We're geeks.
We're queeks.
Superheroes, Star Wars,
Broadway, Drag Race.
So if you're super gay,
super nerdy,
or anything in between, listen to Queeks today,
wherever fine podcasts are sold.
And find us on Instagram at Queeks Podcast.
And then when it comes to one of the other main things you mentioned of non-reproductive sex, as you will have heard from the first episode reviewing this book, that is not a uniquely human trait. We listed several of the species that engage in non-reproductive sex, or even cross-species, or even necrophiliac behavior. And it's also not a new thing. People have been using contraception for pretty much as long as there have been people. And with that additional societal context and cultural reference of controlling reproduction as a facet of the spread of human culture anyway, do you feel that the modern interpretation of super stimuli that you put forward in your book is in need of any grounding in that long view of human culture?
So you said a number of points there, so I'll have to address them one by one, I think, there. So what was the first point again? I just want to make sure I connect them all.
Non-reproductive sex. There's a quote in here that no animals. Animal has disconnected sex from reproduction.
Yeah, so completely. So there are no animals that only engage in non-reproductive sex. Humans, there are humans that engage only in non-reproductive sex. And so the difference there is that humans can, you know, other animals can engage in non-reproductive, other forms of sex. And it's not the typical vaginal penis sex that occurs, which I think is the emphasis in the book, you know, that that doesn't occur in animals often without reproduction being possible. It does occur in humans without that being possible. And that the major shift on your second point, in that contraception's been around for a long time, it's about the effectiveness of the contraception and a change in the effectiveness in the contraception that occurred around 1870. And so when vulcanized rubber condoms came around, you know, they dramatically improved the effectiveness of contraception. And when that is combined with the abortive methods that they had back then that changes the way we potentially have sex. And that's good in many ways. You know, I mean, that helps lead to reductions in protections from overpopulation. You know, I mean, this is a wonderful thing that occurred, you know, and it was largely a solution to the Malthusian problems of overpopulation. But this has impacted us to such a degree that now we are reproducing well below the replacement rate. And so that's leading to a slow degrade in the current populations in many, many societies.
I want to come back to the overpopulation and population on a finite planet point that we raised later. But also having non-reproductive sex, a species that doesn't exclusively engage in non-reproductive sex makes sense because you need that to survive. But also within a reproductive population, there are going to be individuals that do not engage in reproductive sex because, as we phrased in the previous episode, they do not have the compatible anatomy or the way of exchanging gametes, or just like they're not doing that right there and then. I'm talking about gays. And there's no mention of that in this book as well. Was that just like not a point that had been considered in terms of child rearing, in terms of fertility?
Gay people can have kids currently. You know, that's a net positive for this. It was potentially harder in past times without individuals having outside partners to help with that. So, I mean, the reproductive success of lesbians and gay men currently is fantastic. You know, I think that
adoption is about as old as people as well, or fostering, yeah, or bringing into an extended family group.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think that from an evolutionary point, there's a potential, and I don't know this for certain, that having gay brothers and sisters, you know, they may help raise kids as well, you know, even if they couldn't have had or didn't want to have sex with people of the opposite sex in the past. Though I think they also did reproduce at higher rates in the past as well, even then, because the dichotomy is not exact. You know, people who are lesbians sometimes have sex with men. Homosexual men, they sometimes have sex with women. That's less so than a lesbian. Sexual dispersal tends to be a little more flexible than male sexual dispersal, but not completely. It does happen as well in the past. And in the past, with reproduction being quite easy, you know, thousands of years ago, reproduction being quite easy, it only needed to happen once or twice as well for individuals that have children.
And then that does lead on to a point that you raised about ways of controlling reproductive behaviors through having either non-reproductive sex or using contraceptive methods or abortive methods, leading to a way of just not having babies that you don't want to have, and how that is providing some kind of buffer against the fear of overpopulation on Earth. I mean, first of all, good that people only have the babies that they want to have. That is good, right?
Yep. Yes, definitely.
And then
the issue is just increasing the number of people who want to have kids so that we can have more children that want to be had, in terms of my opinion on this. Yes.
Then you might consider that, given the world that we live in, the one of fires in the Arctic, the ones of massive political upset and destabilization, the ones of an insecure future for the people who are alive on this planet today, bringing another life into the world when we are not sure that we could provide it a better or even an adequate life based on the society that we live in and the society that we expect to live in over the eventual child's lifetime. You can understand why people are hesitant or reticent to possibly inflict that on someone.
Yeah, and it's an interesting question because I think a lot of it has to do with our ability to understand what's going on in the world. I think that's greatly increased over time. And despite us living in a relatively peaceful time in history, wars are at a much lower minimum than they were comparatively hundreds of years ago. But there are lots of problems, you know, and we recognize them and we see them and we are trying to solve them. And I think the next generation needs to be a part of that. I think having kids and bringing kids into this world to help solve these problems is important, because us just giving up and saying we can't bring people into this world because it's going to be too tough on them, I understand why people feel that way, because there are a lot of struggles in the world currently, but I think we need to push on, you know, as people and as a societies. Yeah.
This is a little off topic from what we've mentioned in our past episode and what you mentioned in the book, but have you encountered the Voluntary Human Extinction Project at all?
I haven't, actually.
People who kind of take that feeling very much to heart of, I didn't ask to be born into this world, and I consider the ongoing existence of the human species on this planet to be ultimately detrimental to other life on the planet and the global environment as a whole, so I will choose to not have children.
Interesting. Yes. I didn't know the name of the group, but I have heard of similar issues in it. And it's an interesting point. You know, I think that human life is valuable, but other people might not. You know, some people might view humanity as unnecessary for the planet. And that's a different opinion than I have. I can't, you know, say that their values are wrong. I just don't agree with them. So I hope that people, more people than not, view humanity as an important part of the world, and that we can find ways to live within it and to live peacefully within it and to support the environment, and et cetera.
Well, with the value of human life that you acknowledge, the pressure of reproduction is inherently on the female component of the human species at the moment, that the pain of pregnancy, of childbirth, and a lot of the societal pressure to do with child rearing and the care for infants and young children through into adolescence, that does weigh very heavily on women. Like, we can address the societal stuff on a broad political level, but the phrase that you use of, if a woman does not get pregnant after sex, however, she does not feel a direct pain from it.
Yes. So that was...
Hearing that back, do you understand why I've just put the tab yikes beside it?
If it's read in isolation, I think it sounds a lot worse than it does in the context of how we decide to have children. So that's the, I think, believe the whole paragraph goes something along the lines of sex without reproduction, or sex evolved as a through positive reinforcement, that we have sex because it feels good, and therefore we have children, and that's how it occurs for most animals. But for other things, like with food and thirst and sleep, that if we don't have food or drink or sleep, then we get hungry or tired or thirsty, and that's a secondary form of negative reinforcement that continues to encourage that behavior. With reproduction, it's only a positive reinforcement process, that there isn't this separate bodily function that occurs that's only relieved through having children. And so it's just an understanding of the reward system that goes into it. And it's not a critique on that there should be. It's just we need to understand that it's not going to occur without thoughtful action, if that makes sense.
The emphasis that is placed on women in this book and through a lot of the examples that you give of how we need to, in your view, reduce the pain of child rearing and encourage the younger generation to have kids soon and plentifully, like, that does weigh most heavily upon women.
And I hope it doesn't. Like, I know it does currently, but I hope that men will equally take this as a important thing for the future, and that we will live in more egalitarian societies, you know, where men and women will both share the burden for this moving forward. And I think that what you see in the research is that countries that are more egalitarian end up reproducing at higher levels. So if you look within Europe and you look at the Nordic countries, they're reproducing at higher levels than a country like Italy, which is less egalitarian than the Nordic countries. And so I think the egalitarianness of a society will help us. I think it's only a positive. I do understand that currently there might be more pressure on women, and so it might cause more concern when an individual is trying to promote reproduction. And I completely understand that. I think we need to ease as much as possible those differences and the journey towards parenthood.
But you can see how on reading this book, I do also have a tab that just says Handmaid's Tale.
That's because very interesting. Yeah.
The reproductive utility of women is something that, from my reading of it, and possibly from other people's readings, you've mentioned that you've had some other feedback, that seems to be an unfortunate viewpoint that comes across through this book.
Yeah, that is interesting, because I was specifically trying to avoid that. Like, I don't think this is something that we need to put on women to solve. Like, I think this is something we all need to solve. But I think that even talking about this provides that idea due to this. I mean, just even talking about reproductive increases leads individuals to think that people will have unwanted pregnancies. And I think I try and make clear in the book that we need to increase wanted pregnancies. We need to increase the ability for people to have kids easily. We need to increase the reproductive purpose that people see, that they need to be able to see characters in movies and on TV and that showcase parents in positive lights and don't kind of shy away from providing the parental scene and the negatives, and don't avoid those issues, and that we need to promote parenthood, you know, that individuals need to feel good about being a parent and not feel a burden to their parents or to others. Because I think when individuals can find a reproductive purpose and can find positivity in it, that they'll be more likely to have kids.
Well, this is ultimately to the solutions chapter. And again, despite the very divergent path of the middle, we do end up at the same idea of social support network, a way of giving people every option that they want to take. It feels like you've wound up at that people should just get a good paying job, just invest wisely, just start a family with their high school sweetheart as soon as possible, and just live in a pro-social government country. And you understand my apprehension in thinking that that is not going to be very easy for a lot of people to get to a place where that is happening for them, that that is the support that they have on a societal level, and at the same time being in that non-egalitarian society that you mentioned, someone could read this book or see the data from the Lancet study and say, aha, so we need to get more women breeding without addressing those underlying social safety concerns, and that will lead to all manner of awfulness.
Yes, I agree. And I think that's one of the important things that we talk about and that we continue to recognize, you know, that that's not what I'm trying to promote in this book. I'm not trying to promote get women pregnant unwantingly. You know, I think that individuals need to be encouraged and they need to be supported. And I think that families need to be supportive. And the more that we can combine the families that we have, the generations that we have, and create communities that are supportive of child rearing, I think will dramatically increase the probability that individuals will have children. And I think that we have a potential, not a definite, that we can overcome this problem.
There was something that came up in our reading that you may remember from our review episode. The quote, Lady Boys of Thailand. I understand if you would rather not have this in the show, but the Lady Boys of Thailand, the Kathoei third gender, they seem to represent a particular problem from this book of defrauding men of reproductive purpose by being more attractive or more alluring than women despite a biological incompatibility. And that struck us in a very weird and uncomfortable way. Is there anything that you'd like to say to address that?
Yeah, and that's unfortunate because that obviously wasn't my plan for that. You know, it was just to illustrate the ability of us to create different or artificially enhanced beauty. And if we can take a person from the other gender and turn them into the other gender, I think that speaks to how far we've come. And it's not necessarily a problem in that case. You know, it's not an issue that that's occurring. It's just an illustration that when we can do that in many different ways, and then when we consistently provide those enhanced visions to individuals, that it can alter our psychology. You know, that if we're consistently influenced with, you know, pornography where individuals are artificially enhanced and they act in extremely enticing manners and they're consistently acting as one would want of a partner in that situation, in whatever that want is, because there are so many varieties of pornography, that can lead to less connection to one's partner and less belief that one should remain in the relationship, and can even influence one's belief that one should have kids, and which is an interesting finding. You know, it's interesting to find that when you give people pornography, they report wanting fewer kids than if you don't give them pornography. And that's a counterintuitive one in many ways. And maybe you disagree with the finding or disagree with the connections
I was expecting that the paragraphs that are on the negative health impacts of porn addiction, of recurrent porn use, that is a just and valid health concern to be raised and to be discussed on a societal and family level, the knock-on effects it can have for attitudes towards women and expectations of relationships. But equally that the surgical modification or enhancement or augmentation of a body for reasons of gender alignment, even that is outside of the Western approach to the gender binary, then that is, like, that's not for men, that is not to distract from a reproductive purpose, that many of these people end up doing sex work is more of a reflection on the cultural pressures that they have and the only ways that they have of surviving, which also then exist outside of those with law protection or those with a societal support. Like, no one in Thailand is getting a gender change or gender confirmation surgery just to end up in sex work or just to try and attract sexual attention.
Yeah, I agree. And if I was not clear on that in the book, then that is a fault of mine. You know, I was trying to illustrate the ability and not have any sort of judgment on the occurrence or why it's happening. It's just to illustrate how powerful we are at creating images and changing things to look in a way that is modified towards our attraction.
I feel like we're kind of coming to a natural conclusion here of that society should support people to make the right choices for their family, for their independence, for their body, and if those empower people to have children and to stay in relationships, then that's all for the better for them. But that despite some interpretations of some parts or some paragraphs of this book, there should not be undue pressure on women to breed, to support the failing population of a people or ethnicity. Would that be the kind of conclusion we should come away from this book with?
Yes, I think that's a good way of putting it. And I would hope that the reader would take that away from it. And if they haven't in any way, then that is an issue that I put. But I tried to as many times as possible to say that this isn't a problem for women. This is a problem for all of us, you know, and we need to find ways of coming together as societies to help avoid the cultural extinctions that I believe are likely to occur.
So. Yeah, the misreading of your intent is something which, looking back on the comments that we made, I think has been evident that from our reading of it, there has been some misinterpretation, and we have approached it from as neutral and as scientific a point as possible without the political impetus to use it to justify any policy. Do you have any concerns if you were to reissue this book in a second edition or to make any changes to the ebook, is there anything that you would change or try and adjust the emphasis on with that?
I think a number of points of the book you've pointed out to situations where the reader might come to a different conclusion than I'm trying to point out. And I do worry a little bit in terms of the book that it could be used for nefarious purposes, you know, but I think that despite those problems, we need to address this problem because it's a serious one in my opinion, you know, that these cultural extinctions are likely to occur if we don't take any action, and that we need to address this in an honest and open way and hopefully a respectful way.
And are you going to continue your work on sexual health, possibly bringing in those perspectives that we mentioned regarding migration, immigration, cultural change over time, and the inclusion of perspectives of the LGBTQ spectrum as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm going to revisit the book and perhaps add a addendum or something to address some of these things, because I think it's important and I want people to come away with a broad understanding of it. And I think without me talking about it with an individual, that and a book being in isolation, I think that individuals might avoid understanding the science that I'm trying to explain and the hypotheses I'm trying to provide and the dangers that are potential to these many cultures if I'm not careful and if I don't make sure that this is in a positive and a comforting light, and where individuals believe that they are not being made to do behaviors that they wouldn't want to do.
Thank you very much for being available for this interview, even having listened back to our past episode. And I'd understand how, having heard that, you might not want to engage in any discussion or debate. So thank you for that.
Oh, no, thank you for giving me the time here. And I did hear it, and you know, it gave me a little bit of cause for concern. But I think that we just need to be open to discussing these issues. And I think if people are honest and open, and that we can help solve them. So I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thanks again to Dr. Lamborn for his availability, even after that first review.
And I will say, I still don't agree that the super stimuli are the major cause of low reproductive rates. I would still expect that mostly it's the state of the world. But I would say that I do fundamentally agree that a healthier and more compassionate society is likely to solve the issue.
Taylor Watt, if everyone just builds a healthy, safe and supportive society in case, and then we'll just take things from there. If you would like to tell us how you're getting started on a safe and supportive society for those closest to you and your community, tell us about what you're doing at eurekanerdcast@gmail.com.
That's eurekanerdcast@gmail.com.
You can find us on Twitter as well, @EurekaNerdcast, or on Facebook @forward/EurekaNerd.
And if you like the work we're doing and you want to help support us, there are a couple of ways you can do that.
You can send us money through Patreon @patreon.com/EurekaNerd, or send one-off payments through Ko-fi @ko-fi.com/EurekaNerd.
And until next time, that's goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.
This podcast is brought to you by the Stimulus Network.
Physical Attraction is the show that explains physics, science, and technology. From the existential threats to humanity, to the impact of technologies on our society, through to the fundamental physics that lies behind it all, we'll take you on a trip through nuclear fusion, neutron stars, artificial intelligence, and quantum mechanics. From interviewing experts to intricately researched narrative episodes, Physical Attraction strives to explain fundamental questions about how the universe works and where the world is going. You can find Physical Attraction at www.physicspodcast.com, on social media as PhysicsPod, and wherever you listen to podcasts. www.physicspodcast.com